Today on BoodleNetwork.com, episode 229, A Conversation with Paul Spiegelman. Welcome inside the Ellis Studio. My name is Randy Cantrell, your host here. You will find the show notes at BULANetwork.com/229. Meet Paul Spiegelman. He's another Dallas-Fort Worth guy. Okay, he came here via the West Coast. But he's a Texan now. He's a Dallas-Fort Worth guy with some very noteworthy accomplishments. In fact, I'll just read his bio from his website. Paul Spiegelman is Chief Culture Officer of Stericycle, a NASDAQ-listed global services organization with 13,000 employees, and is founder of Barrel Health and the Barrel Institute. Paul also co-founded the Inc. Small Giants Community, an organization that brings together leaders who are focused on value-based business principles. He is an author. He is a speaker. He is a culture enthusiast, and we talk about all of that. I interviewed Paul last year for the not-yet-launched project, Chasing DFW Cool. Still planning to launch that project, but I've got too many of these really good conversations, and I just need to release them so that you can benefit. We talk about leadership, culture, customer service, writing, and lots of other topics that Paul cares a great deal about. And hey, he's a Dallas Stars hockey fan, so I knew I'd like him right away. I think you'll like him too. I'll bring you the interview. We'll dive right into it. Have some closing comments at the end. Enjoy. You're a trained attorney. I'm rather curious. What was the first goal? What was the first dream that you had?
Well, my dream probably started years before that when I was growing up and was dashed quickly, which was to be a doctor. So I always wanted to be a doctor growing up, but by getting, I think, a D in calculus in my freshman year in college at UCLA, I realized that was going to be short-lived. And then I think probably to make my Jewish mom happy, decided after school to go to law school and become a lawyer. So did it for a very short time, about a year and a half, before my brothers and I decided to get into business together, which we did in 85 in Los Angeles.
Now, was Barrel, was that the first endeavor?
No, actually, we started in a little different business. We started in the medical alert business. We were providing medical alert systems for elderly and people with medical conditions. So you think of the bootstrapped business, that was us. We made this unit in my garage that had holes in it for a speakerphone, and we would put it in people's homes. And from day one, we had this little 8x10 room that acted as our response center, and we had a little receiving unit in there. So if someone had a problem, one of us would be sleeping overnight on a cot waiting for calls to come in, and we could send out help to people that needed it. So the emergency response business was the original business, and because we couldn't afford to sell to the public, we would go to hospitals and have them offer the service to patients that left the hospital, and built that up for a couple years. And then as many of us realize in business, we're not sure what direction we're going to head in or what we're actually going to end up doing, but one of our clients asked us if we could put in a phone line for them, since we were there 24/7, and answer calls from people calling from the community looking for doctors, what they called a physician referral service. And I had never heard of that before, but seemed easy enough to do. And 2 weeks later, we were answering calls for this hospital in Southern California. Turned out every hospital in the country had this capability, so we essentially became an outsourced provider of call center services for hospitals, and then that was really the business that we've grown to where it is today. We sold the original emergency response business in the early 90s, but that physician referral service turned out to be the foundation for the call center business we're in today.
And, of course, my fascination, we talked before we kind of went on the air the whole customer service, the whole part of your description on your website is speaker, author, leader, culture enthusiast, and it's that culture enthusiast part. Where does that come from?
You know, I get that question a lot as I speak around culture and employee engagement, and which really became our calling card. And like you, I'm very focused on customer service, but I felt that the best way to ensure a customer service culture was to develop an employee engagement culture where people that were working in the business felt valued for what they did. And I got to tell you, it's not something that was by design. My brothers and I think, were just raised by parents with good core values, and we were taught to be nice and never burn a bridge and treat people with respect. And we came to learn that that's not how all businesses run. It was probably in the early days when we had 10 or 15 people that a few employees would comment about how this was a fun place to work. And we would say, well, what made it fun? And they said, well, you seem to really care about us. We do things together. And we'd say, well, where'd you used to work? And then they'd start with the stories of how they were treated at previous places. And we'd say, wow, you know, that's too bad, but we can now this turn this into something really special. And so we essentially made the culture become our secret sauce that not only led to customer loyalty, but ultimately allowed us to be a premium provider and charge much more for our services in a otherwise commodity business, call center businesses, and really be recognized as a best place to work.
You know, and most of us, I think we either learn by example, somebody that taught us how to do it right, and sadly, I think too many of us, we may have worked for a jerk, and we learned, okay, we don't want to do it that way. But do you have any of that in your history? I mean, any work experience with somebody that you thought, man, I do not want to do it this way?
We really don't. I mean, we started so early that none of us had that kind of experience, which you would have expected would lead us to do it this way. It's really all that we knew. But we were, I think, smart enough in the early days to realize that it was something unique, and that made us want to do it more. And then that made us want to kind of put a label on it and talk about it and brand it in a way that our customers understood what the culture meant to them.
I've heard you before address the fact of some benefit of a little bit of business ignorance. I'd like you to tell the story of the CFO that you hired who clearly knew all the business metrics and measurements, and here you guys are just kind of feeling your way in the dark and doing what you think is the right thing to do. Some of those internal struggles, particularly with a CFO who's going to be so geared on the bottom line, how challenging, and describe some of those conversations internally.
The question people ask really is there a choice? Do you have to have, you know, a good, fun culture or, you know, a profitable company? And I think the answer is both. And yet the more traditional financial folks would probably not agree or wouldn't think that way. So you're right, when we hired our first CFO back in 2002, I think it was, and he came in and he saw all this fun stuff and dress-up days and parties and events that we would do, and he said, Paul, I know the first thing we should do to drive the bottom line, and that's stop doing these cultural events. And I said, Pat, I don't know if I could quantify it for you, but I got to believe there's some connection between the environment we create for our people and the fact that we're, you know, very profitable and continue to grow. And it was really Pat who, 4 years later, became such a believer and disciple of these cultural efforts that driving to see a customer one day, he coined what became our overriding philosophy that we call the circle of growth, which simply says that if you focus first and foremost on your people, that's going to drive their loyalty, which will then in turn drive customer loyalty, which will then drive profit into our business, which we then commit to return into our people to give them better tools and resources to do their jobs, and the cycle simply continues. So it's a very simple philosophy that I'm very proud was coined by our CFO and has really lived with us ever since. So the financial folks may need some education on their own about the impact that this can have to the bottom line, but we're getting there over time.
Do you attribute any of this, any of your philosophy and any of your passion for the culture for employees, to Well, let me just ask you this way. Do you have a belief in the inherent goodness of people? I mean, because you just certainly don't come across as a guy like so many business people who are just jaded, who believe that if we give the employees an inch, they'll take a mile.
Not only do I believe in the inherent goodness of people, but I even believe in the inherent goodness of most people who have been put into leadership positions, but are kind of blindsided by the financial pressures and looking at the finances as leading indicators of their success in decision-making, and believing or being taught that the command and control method of leadership is going to achieve better results. I think that even within that group of people, there are those who, in their hearts, might even consider doing it another way, but don't either have the confidence or the training to do it. People want to be happy and fulfilled in what they do. It's human nature, whether you're the leader or you're the frontline worker. So we believe that, of course, people inherently are good and will treat each other well and with respect if given the opportunity to do that, and it's going to make everyone's lives better. It's not to say that we don't have the same challenges as every other business, whether it's people that are negative influencers or have the entitlement mentality or push against the kinds of things that we're doing. And the fact is, we have a great sense of accountability around that and make sure that if people aren't meant to be part of this company or they're going to have a negative influence on others, then we're going to seek them, find them, and make them uncomfortable so that they find a way out of the organization.
I know that the company culture was one. It was that typical slow to hire and quick to fire, or quick to move somebody on when you knew it just obviously it was not going to be a good fit.
Yeah, it's something that we all learn over time, and as leaders, we're challenged by that. It's a very tough thing to do, and so we need more courage to make those decisions, because when in our heart we know that someone doesn't belong in the organization, we actually owe it to them to act now. But we all procrastinate and find every reason and excuse in the book to do it, and I'm not exempt from that. But over time, we learn that when we finally make that decision and act on it, everybody else is looking at you and say, what took you so long? So the sooner that we can act, it's in everybody's best interests, and we can move on for the betterment of that person and for the company as a whole.
When did the notion to articulate this stuff in a book and then go out and begin to spread this message by speaking, when did that strike?
You know, that was back in, I think, 2005, 2006. My first book came out in 2007. And the purpose really was, one, I wanted our own employees and my kids and others to have, you know, to see what this was about, hear the story, understand that they were a part of something special, to be able to document what we had done over the years. And I realized that after many years in business, I feel like I've had a positive impact on the lives of the people that work in the business, and yet we're certainly looked at as a unique company. And what I believe so strongly in all of this, that I feel like my life's work is now dedicated to convincing other leaders that that this is the right way to do it. So the writing became a platform for me to go out and speak to other leaders and try to convince or convert others that don't otherwise feel this way.
Talk a bit about the Small Giants project, and I'm curious especially about the genesis of that and kind of the over where that organization is today and your goals for that.
Small Giants Community is an organization that came out of me reading a book that I know you've read as well, Randy, called Small Giants by Bo Burlingham. It was written back in 2006, and interestingly, it was just about the time that my first book was coming out. I was looking for someone to write the foreword for my book, and I send a blind email to Bo, who didn't know me, and asked him if he would consider doing that, and he did, and I was so taken by that book and the concepts inside around this multi-stakeholder approach to business and the value of intimate relationships with customers and employees. So over a couple of years, I mentioned to Bo that there were probably many leaders of companies that either considered themselves to be small giants or, more importantly, would aspire to be, and that weren't covered in his book, and he agreed, and we finally decided to start a a community. It's essentially a membership community of leaders of companies who feel this way about business, that we all want to grow and we all want to be successful, but business is more than just making money. It's about helping make the world a better place. It's about creating relationships with all the stakeholders in our business and having a higher purpose for what we do. So we have several events during the course of the year and local groups and ways to visit other companies that would be viewed as small giants and basically help teach others and share best practices.
So in the last 5 to 7 years since the books and the Small Giants Project, you're out and about much more than the average bear. Are you seeing more and more this shift in culture and this awareness of leadership to treat people differently, better?
I'm very happy to see these trends, and I think we have a long way to go. Unfortunately, the business leaders that we hear about on the news are not necessarily the business leaders that we want to follow, because it's the ones that are the crooks or doing bad things that end up making the news. But it's those small, medium-sized business owners that are doing things right that are really making a difference, especially in growing the economy. So we're trying to bring some value and some visibility to those companies. I think that over the next 10-15 years, we're really going to look at this more transformational leadership style becoming standard, and rather than me being unique as a way to operate the business or my leadership style, that it will become much more accepted going forward. Because once leaders feel the impact of not only treating people well and the impact that they can have on other people's lives, but how they're actually going to make more money and be more profitable, ultimately, who wouldn't want to do it? It's just that we still have great pressure on companies, particularly public companies who live and die by quarterly earnings, to stop and realizing that there's a better way to do it.
Is the next generation, the current and the next generation of workers, what impact do you see them having? I mean, for example, I'm the father of a 33-year-old son. My son at 33 wired very differently than I was at 33, very experience-driven, which to me seems to be indicative of his generation. For instance, we're hockey fans, and if given the opportunity to have a certain amount of money, or let's say season tickets to the Stars, he's taken tickets to the Stars, where my generation seemed to be more bent on the car, the stuff. Does that make sense? I'm curious what perception, what you see in the generations as far as their tolerance and what they even want in a workplace versus, say, my generation.
I think there is tremendous hope for the future because of that. Not only because of your son at his age, but when I go out and I talk to college students and I'm able to judge an annual business plan competition called Values and Ventures at TCU that focuses not just on the business, but on the values that that these young folks are thinking about, they are looking for something different. They are looking for the experience. They want more out of life. And what I love about that is that whether it's starting a business or even where they work, they're being more picky about what they are choosing, and I think that's a great trend to see. So I have great hope for the future based on the next couple of generations of people coming into the workforce.
Now, I know that a significantly larger company bought your company last year. Any emotions to that as a founder? And I know that you're now the chief culture officer with this larger company that took your own, but I'm curious of any feelings and emotions and what that struggle was like.
Well, there's a ton of feeling and emotion that goes along with selling your company and your baby that you started 28 years ago in a garage. There's no question about that. But through multiple years of thinking about and talking to people and deciding what I wanted not only for my family but for the employees of Barrel, we were approached by this large public company in the healthcare space called Stericycle back in late 2011. And after almost a year of dialogue, I became comfortable that this was the right thing to do in order to help our business grow, and that would give our culture the greatest chance of success and sustainability long term. And it's turned out to be everything and more that I expected. Many of our people have gotten new and bigger opportunities. The culture has not only remained, but this bigger company has looked to our small one as an example they want to follow. And I was honored by given the role of Chief Culture Officer, as you said, to now try to bring culture and engagement to a company and with hundreds of locations, 14,000 employees, 12 different countries across the globe, that is public and dealing with those quarterly issues. But we have buy-in at the top, tremendous support, and I'm really looking forward to telling the story of how I was able to go from our small company to a multinational company, and that size really doesn't matter, that the same concepts are scalable and will work to achieve the same result.
Any special challenges as far as trying to implement this kind of a culture globally?
Yes, there's a long list of challenges, the first of which is basic communication. So while in my business at Barrel, we had 400 people all literally in one building, and it's pretty easy to create that culture. When you have a company in disparate locations that don't have a common method of communication, that's already a big challenge. For example, in the U.S., out of 9,000 team members, only 5,000 have email. We have 1,500 drivers whose mode of communication is coming in every morning, grabbing their orders on a bulletin board and hitting their route. So we have to find kind of a common denominator of communication, or in many cases multiple ways to communicate to all levels of people so that they get the messages, that they can participate, that we can get their feedback and feel like we're touching people across the company. And this is a company that's got a lot of gaps around training and development, and while they've had tremendous financial success, have never really focused on the employee as a key stakeholder. So many opportunities, many challenges, but when you have the kind of support that I've been given at the top and this commitment to realizing that this is what's going to drive the company's success in the next 10 or 15 years, then I give us a really good chance of success. And it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, everybody realizes that this is a multi-year initiative. It's not a project. It's not a program. It just becomes who we are.
Talk to me, Paul, about a leader and the power of expectation, particularly, you know, among those people that a person is trying to lead. I'm curious your thoughts.
I think any culture is, it could be easily defined as the ability of the leader to set the tone and to participate. We are essentially a reflection of our leader's personality, whether it's my small company being a reflection of my personality, whether Stericycle being a reflection of the CEO, whether it's Southwest Airlines being the reflection of Herb Kelleher as the founder. There's just no question the impact that the leader has. And I do believe that if we don't have a leader that gets it, that supports it, that walks the walk, that culture efforts, particularly in a company that's trying to change the culture, are going to fail. So we have to engage and teach our leaders that this is one thing you can't delegate. You have to be genuine about it, and you have to own it, and you have to participate.
Well, I appreciate your time, Paul. He is Paul Spiegelman. He is a New York Times bestselling author. The books include Why Is Everyone Smiling?, Smile Guide, Patience Comes Second. He was a founder of Barrel Corporation, recently sold, and CEO founder of Small Giants. Paul, I'm encouraging the people in our audience to personally reach out either through social media or some other way of your choice and to say thank you for your time, and what's the best way for people to do that?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Randy. Anybody's welcome to go to paulspiegelman.com, to my website. They can reach out to me then, send me an email. I'd love to hear stories of what people are doing in their own businesses to engage their people.
And another book in the works?
Well, not at the moment. I'm taking a little bit of a break, but I do believe my current role in the public company will be something we're going to want to document, so I'm journaling quite a bit.
Well, great. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks for being on the show, Paul.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed Paul Spiegelman. I've got a few more of these that I will bring you. Interviews that were recorded originally for that project, Chasing DFW Cool. Just decided it just time to unwrap them and get them out there. So reach out to Paul. Tweet him. Thank you for participating, sharing his insights. I hope you got something from it. I'd encourage you to check out his website, paulspiegelman.com. Read his books. Go check out the Small Giants community. Read that book, too. Pretty terrific stuff. If you're into small business, if you're into leadership, if you're into culture building, it's all very terrific stuff. What I'd like you to do for me, okay, it's not about me, but this part is, subscribe to the newsletter. I will send you a free video. It's entitled 15 Obstacles to Success or Greater Success. You can get that free simply by going to the website, plugging in your email address in the upper right-hand corner in that yellow box. I'll send it to you. I've even got a free bonus ebook and a free audiobook that I will send you as well. So my name is Randy Cantrell, coming to you from Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas, where all the cool people are. People like Paul. Hey, people like me. BulaNetwork.com is the website. This is the Yellow Studio.